This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Friday, April 12th. I'm Gavin McGough.
And I'm Julia Caulfield.
In today's headlines, county adjusts zone district, responding to concern.
Mountain Village discusses fire mitigation and tree protections.
Quilters retreat to canyon country.
And a mountain weather forecast. But first, Telluride Marshals are continuing to investigate a series of vandalism incidents this week. As KOTO News reported earlier, the tires of two deputy vehicles were slashed on Sunday night. Following our reporting, another deputy vehicle had its tires slashed outside the Marshals Department on Tuesday night between 6 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. the following morning. Town officials note investigators are reviewing security camera footage in the area, but are also asking for information from the public. Anonymous tips can be made by calling 970-249-9110 or emailing lmills@telluride-co.gov.
Responding to public input, San Miguel County Planning Commissioners are recommending changes to the Community Housing Zone District. The county's newest zone district, the CH Zone, was ratified by the county commissioners in December 2021.
And the purpose of the zone district is to provide for the development of high-density clustered housing for people who live and work within San Miguel County.
That's County Planning Director Kay Simonson speaking at last week's Planning Commission meeting. The zone district has all sorts of limitations. A development faces height restrictions, setbacks, open space stipulations. It must work with wastewater infrastructure, mitigate traffic impacts, and use renewable energy. But the core goal of allowing high-density clustered development has made it a source of controversy. Many residents say it could open the door to developments which stain Telluride's pristine open space. Responding to those concerns, county commissioners and planning commissioners have been revising the CH. Currently, the zone can accommodate a density of up to 20 units per acre. Simonson recalls that at a prior meeting,
we did have a discussion as to whether it should be reduced to 15 units per acre. Ultimately, it was decided to not change that at that time.
The commissioners are discussing other adjustments as well. They've eliminated controversial phrases, softened the purpose statement, and increased the level of review each project receives. But last week, conversation focused on the big sticking point: density, density, density. Simonson clarifies how the county calculates a development density.
You know, somebody's got a 50-acre parcel, they only plan to put development on, say, 10 acres. We don't base the density on the 10 acres, we do base it on the full 50.
The implication? Housing could be very clustered, as long as buildings fit the county's height limitation, a maximum of 35 feet. So 20 units to an acre could look like a lot more. Commissioner Galena Gleason says what they need is a visual.
A simple way for people to actually be like, oh, this is cut and dry, and this, I can envision this level of density, right? And what I'm hearing and how what I feel about this, trying to wrestle this, is like, what is it going to look like, right? Like, what is this level of density going to look like? And that's been my question from the beginning, starting to work with this.
Commissioners dive into troubleshooting. Can the code be fixed so county residents will rest easy, knowing apartment complexes and sprawling neighborhoods will be kept at bay? Despite their efforts, the majority of residents during public comment simply ask for the commissioners to do away with the zone district entirely. A few, it must be noted, come to voice their support for affordable housing and for the CH zone. Following the comment period, Commissioner Lee Taylor says,
our efforts to date would suggest that abolishing the CH zone district is not something that we're contemplating.
Additionally, the county has land zoned under CH, which makes it difficult to do away with. The Alexander parcel in Ilium is owned by the town of Mountain Village, which plans to develop workforce housing, with the possibility of some free market units to offset costs and some commercial space. Mountain Village will have to comply with any changes made to the CH district language. commissioners discuss a number of approaches to the density issue, but in the end, they settle on perhaps the simplest. Lower the allowable density to up to 15 units per acre, down from 20. That is, of course, subject to review by the Planning Commission and the County Commission. It is not given outright. Commissioners also tighten the language around free market units. After 4 hours of work, commissioners and staff are weary, but hope they've done good by county residents.
If anybody ever writes the perfect zone district, I'd love to see it.
But that's what we're going to do right now.
Yeah. We'll all get a Nobel Prize.
Commissioners send their recommended adjustments, including the lower 15 unit per acre maximum, subject to the discretion of the decision maker, onto the Board of County Commissioners, who will have a final vote on the adjusted CH zone district language.
Mountain Village is looking to update its fire mitigation and tree protection regulations.
The current fire mitigation regulations that we have within the CDC were based on 2003 standards. Both fire mitigation science and practices have evolved since then, and we'd like to follow along with those times.
That's Amy Ward, Mountain Village Community Development Director, speaking at a recent town council meeting. The CDC is the Community Development Code. Currently, Mountain Village has defensible space zones, regulations on what plants or materials are allowed to be in certain proximity to a home to help keep it safe from fire. Updates to the regulations would change those zones. Zone 3 would run from 30 to 100 feet away from a building, up to 200 feet on a steep slope. The zone would focus on keeping fire on the ground and driving crown fires, those jumping from treetop to treetop, back to the ground where it will be less intense. Zone 2 runs from 5 to 30 feet from the building and looks to reduce fuels in the area and create space between the buildings, trees, and other flammable vegetation. Zone 1 is where there's the most change. Ward says the area would be reduced from 0 to 15 feet from the home to 0 to 5 feet.
But it's substantially more restrictive. And so it is going to really impact the way people in the future landscape around their homes.
Zone 1 would require individuals to remove all flammable material, including vegetation, from the area.
It is a different way of landscaping. It's talking about primarily hardscape within the first 5 feet of a home. So your traditional shrubs and bushes right up against your windows are not going to be allowed within this scenario.
Ward says the mitigation efforts would go into effect for any new development and any redevelopment of a certain size. While it would be a big change for landscaping in the region, Ward notes it does fall in line with industry best practices. She also highlights a home in the Lahaina fire in Hawaii that was saved while the homes around it burned.
The experts basically say that the reason that this home wasn't destroyed is primarily because it has a metal roof and because it had a gravel buffer around the edges of the home. Granted, they didn't put that gravel buffer there for the reasons of fire protection. It was actually for termites, but it served the same purpose in this case. So this is a pretty stunning example of why we're looking in that direction.
Moving away from fire mitigation and into tree protection, Ward recommends adding language into the CDC to create a tree protection zone, construction of a chain link fence and steel posts around trees, and require a tree protection sign to be on all fencing when developing lots in town. Ward says they already have tree protection regulations in the CDC, but they're not effective. She says rather than trying to ineffectively protect all the trees on a lot, developers should focus on preserving stunning old trees and keep them healthy.
We do know that our forests are stressed. When we have things like spruce budworm and beetles and all of that, what attracts them? It's stressed and dying trees. So if we have less healthier trees, rather than a lot of really highly stressed trees that are damaged, maybe those sections of forest are going to do better in the long run.
Ward notes the tree protection regulations also align with industry best practices. When it comes to town council's feelings on the matter, it's mixed. Councilmember Scott Pearson doesn't like the idea of a 5-foot buffer around homes.
Yeah, I understand that it provides some incremental fire protection, but saying you can't have flower boxes under your windows or you can't have box shrubs by your home, I'd rather let the insurance companies do their job and say, well, we're not going to insure you if you do this. I don't like the idea of telling our homeowners that they can't have flowers around their houses.
But Mayor Marty Prochazka, who also owns a landscaping company, notes Zone 1 actually fits with ideal landscaping anyway.
Unless you have a non-snow-shedding roof, it is really poor landscape plan to put plants under with that close to your house anyway.
Ward adds there could be some flexibility as long as planters aren't sitting on the ground itself. Councilmember Jack Gilbride says it's a necessary concession.
One of our, if not our biggest threat, is fire, and that we may have to do some sacrifice of beautification around a house in order to better protect ourselves against a fire. I think that's a good thing to do.
When it comes to tree protections, council is concerned about the challenges it could cause for contractors and developers. They wonder if rather than putting big protection measures in place, developers could plant new trees after the fact. Rodney Walters, Mountain Village's town forester, says it's not the same.
As large mature trees by far provide the most benefits. A young tree that is planted, when they're transplanted like they are, they lose 95% of the root zone. It takes them years to reestablish, and then it takes them decades, if they survive, to reach a mature height and provide those benefits.
Mountain Village Town Council is supportive in changing the fire mitigation regulations in the CDC. It would like to see a pilot program for tree protections. Staff will try to work with a contractor over the summer to see how the protections work in the real world. In order to change the community development codes, Town Council will need to vote on an ordinance.
Okay, so I think this is winner of best of show.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, first
place. In a courtyard of the grand hacienda-style gateway resort, way out in the canyon country of Mesa County, a group of women have gathered to vote on the ugliest quilt.
Well, right here. I think right here. First place.
The quilts spread on the lawn are small, the size of a large doormat, and they are indeed ugly, or at least garish, clashing, slapdash. But that's the point of this particular session at the Allegre Quilting Retreat, explained instructor and art quilter Sue Benner.
In a lot of my classes, when I teach layered collage, they do the background because I want three layers. They do the background and they don't want to cover it up because they think it's so beautiful. So I'm purposely having them do something that they don't think is beautiful so that they can cover almost all of it up. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to mind doing that.
Over the next few days, Benner's students will work to collage over their quote-unquote ugly quilts and come out with something intuitive, surprising, and perhaps beautiful. Benner is an accomplished and widely exhibited quilt artist. Today, she presides over a classroom piled high with fabric, irons pumping out steam, and women stooped over their piecing. Each year, at the cusp of spring, quilters from across the country descend on this resort in a distant eddy of Colorado's Red Rock Canyons to enjoy off-season prices and devote themselves to studying with some of the biggest names in the art quilting world. Many here are experienced quilters, but not all. Tina Ray is 23. How did she come to Allegre?
Well, I was trying to figure out how to learn how to quilt because, you know, there's not a lot of places to learn it. And so I ended up searching for workshops, places where, like, everybody would gather together so I could, through osmosis, absorb everybody's wonderful knowledge. And this place was on a list of some quilters' favorite quilting workshop places.
Participants at the week-long retreat sign up for a single intensive course. The day is broken by lunch with a lecture to follow. And for anyone seeking inspiration, trails and pathways beckon, leading up from the resort into the scrubby footlands above the Dolores River. The question of what exactly is an art quilt floats in the air. Delivering a lunch lecture, quilter Lisa Ellis addresses the divisions between craft, fine art, tradition, and modernism.
These categorizations make me crazy. Studio Art Club Associates, our definition is, if it's original, if it's from your head, then it's art. This idea that, well, you know, it's block-based. No, there's nothing that says you can't make something that's block-based. And that it's therefore traditional and not worthy.
Many attendees bring finished work to share. Hanging in the dining room, it makes a collection as diverse and wonderful as can be imagined. Terry Mangett of Taos has taught at Allegre in the past, but this year she's simply attending.
The lady that inspired me to make quilts was Mrs. Earl Clay in Carlisle, Kentucky. I got a degree in art from the University of Kentucky, and then my friend introduced me to her, and she made all these wacky quilts. She lived near a men's underwear factory, and she would just make these quilts, but she used these wacky fabrics from the men's underwear factory. And the fact that she put these weird fabrics together made me want to make quilts.
Ms. Earl Clay, back in Kentucky, worked without a sewing machine, hand-stitching every piece. Says Mangett, for decades, she turned to modern technology.
I thought, well, I would never have the patience to hand quilt. But now I'm like 76 years old, and I find that I love to hand stitch every evening, and my work is now mostly hand-pieced.
The process of working without a machine is extremely time-consuming, but can produce a different sort of product, less polished, certainly, organic. Attendee Barbara Pevney, meanwhile, got into quilting with a close friend after retirement.
When I stopped being in private practice with her as a counselor, I told her, I need to still see you every week. So I went and started quilting with her in her river home on the Animas.
Pevney, who briefly came out of retirement in order to pay the Allegre tuition bill, lived for years in Durango, Colorado, before moving to Fort Collins. To be back in this Western Slope country for such study and practice, Pevney is speechless.
I have no words. You can bring me to tears. I'm a Red Rock girl, and I love the Red Rock, and it's just stunning. Totally stunning here.
Outside, sun mixes with wind and bird song. There's just a hint of new growth on the overwintering trees, and the day is quiet, almost sacred beneath the soaring mesa cliffs. But if you listen through open classroom doors, you can hear the Allegre quilters as they set into their afternoon.
After a few days of quiet streets, shuttered storefronts, and no gondola clamor, you might have transitioned fully into off-season. But the Telluride Ski Resort is already announcing a reopening of sorts, as uphill ski access on resort terrain is now permitted. As of April 12th, mountain operations have cleared resort terrain for recreation, though Telski notes sledding and snowmobiling, or use of any motorized vehicle, is forbidden. Mountain operations reminds uphill skiers and recreators that Ski Patrol is not managing avalanche conditions or responding to emergencies. The ski area should be considered as backcountry terrain. Prospect Basin will close from May 20th through July 1st for elk calving season.
The Colorado Department of Transportation will begin construction on chain stations outside of Telluride next week. The work will take place on Highway 145 from mile markers 67 to 69, that's near the entrance of Mountain Village, and mile markers 70 to 72, near Society Turn. According to CDOT, the purpose of the project is to ensure commercial drivers have a safe location to chain up or down while traveling along mountain passes. Construction will begin on Monday, April 15th, and is expected to be completed in fall 2024. Work will run during daytime hours Monday through Friday. During construction, drivers can expect reduced speeds, single lane and shoulder closures, and brief delays.
Republican State Representative Don Wilson is facing backlash after he left his gun unattended in a public bathroom at the state capitol on Wednesday. Wilson apologized on Thursday in a statement. Democratic House leadership called on Wilson not to carry his gun at the Capitol and said the incident shows the need for gun control legislation. A bill currently under consideration would ban firearms in so-called sensitive spaces, including at the State House. Republican lawmakers have mishandled firearms while on the job before. Last year, two guns were stolen out of Representative Ron Weinberg's car. In 2022, Representative Richard Holtorf accidentally dropped his gun in the public lobby of the House chamber.
The National Park Service has selected a new superintendent of Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. These parks in southeastern Utah attract hundreds of thousands of visitors each year, and they're home to striking geologic formations and significant indigenous cultural sites. The new superintendent, Lena Pace, brings years of experience, having previously worked on a floating ranger station in Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve and at Lake Mead National Recreation Area. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KZMU's Molly Marcello has more.
Pace grew up in Gustavus, Alaska, just outside Glacier Bay, where her parents both worked for the National Park Service. She says while each national park and monument across the country is different, she sees some commonalities.
There are similarities in every park. And, you know, the first thing I would say is I haven't been to a park yet that you didn't go to and recognize that there's a reason that it was protected the way it is, right? Every park is unique and has a really special energy about it in terms of, you know, you can kind of imagine yourself being the first person who saw Arches and said, this would be great to protect as public land. Because I came from a small town in Southeast Alaska, it was a gateway community to a large national park where almost everyone in town, either directly or indirectly, makes a living either because of the park directly, because they work there, or because the park is there, because it's protected and they're able to guide or have businesses or own lodges or you know, help the tourists and the people who are coming to visit. And so Moab reminds me a little bit of my hometown in that respect, the level of pride and ownership and love that the local people have for the park, and the level of support that the parks in the area provide back to the local community and vice versa, kind of that symbiotic relationship where we're all working together towards the same goals and because we love these amazing places. So there's a lot of similarity in that. And then I think the other commonality that we see in all parks is some of the management challenges that we see in Arches and in other parks across the service. You know, our mission tells us that we should protect these places so that future generations can visit them and see them and experience them the way that they are. But it also tells us that we should allow for people to visit them now, right? And so balancing how do we allow for visitation and enjoyment while also making sure these places are protected in a way that our grandchildren's grandchildren can still come and visit them and see them intact in their purest form. That's something that's always we're trying to balance in park management.
Pace joins the Southeast Utah group as Arches National Park pilots its timed entry system for the third year, and Canyonlands National Park launches a new management planning process for the Green and Colorado Rivers.
I'm so grateful for the team at the Southeast Utah group and at Arches who have been caring for this place up until now. They've really been fantastic and helping to get me up to speed and teaching me so much about the park and the resource and the history of that area. I'm really enjoying it and I appreciate all the work that they've done thus far.
A Colorado Sun politics reporter was kicked out of the Colorado GOP assembly, which took place in Pueblo over the weekend. Sandra Fish has been covering politics since 1982. She was escorted out of the state GOP assembly on Saturday by a sheriff's deputy after being told that party chair Dave Williams thinks her current reporting is, quote, very unfair. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KGNU's Jackie Sedley spoke with Sandra Fish about what happened.
So let's just start at the beginning. You were all set to go to the Colorado GOP assembly at the state fairgrounds in Pueblo, and then you received a text around 3:45 a.m. Saturday morning. Is that right?
Yes, I did. And it's worth noting that I did attend the 3rd Congressional District and the 4th Congressional District nominating assemblies on Friday, which were really the big news coming out of this. But I had asked about credentials and I got this text at 3:45 a.m. saying that, you know, I wasn't going to be let in, but I thought, hey, I'm going to try to go anyway. I've been going to these for a long time. And, you know, this is a group of about 3,000 or 4,000 Republicans making decisions on behalf of all 900,000 registered Republicans in the state. And so I went, and they, you know, I went in the door, they gave me a press credential. And I was like hanging out, talking to people that I know and people that I don't, and new friends. And, you know, then they, after I'd been there a little more than an hour, and they realized I was there and got rid of me.
And what was the interaction like between you and those that told you you had to leave?
You know, the security staff at the event center was kind of apologetic and just like, you've got to go. I finally, Eric Grossman, who's was the event coordinator, came over and talked to me, but refused to answer any of my questions about what is it that's unfair. He seemed kind of angry. And the deputy, they were totally professional. I mean, it was fine. It, you know, I get that I have written stories about the Colorado GOP's finances in the past year. They're not good. First time since at least 20 years that they haven't employed full-time staff. I've written about the chairman using party resources to promote his candidacy for the 5th congressional district. And I expect that's what he is angry about. But I would like specifics, because has he called and corrected anything about those stories? Nope.
So when they said that Colorado Republican Party Chairman Dave Williams finds your current reporting very unfair, it sounds like you maybe had an idea right off the bat what they might have been referring to. Have you heard feedback like this before from other Republicans or other folks that maybe aren't appreciative of your reporting?
You know, there are people who don't want to be covered in what they perceive as a negative light. I mean, at the end of in February, I went up to Representative Elizabeth Epps in the Capitol to ask her why she had been participating only remotely in House floor sessions. I mean, she was clearly in the Capitol that day, right after the House floor session that she'd participated in remotely. And she refused to talk to me. She just sort of looked at me, and I asked her a question several times, and there's a recording of that. I mean, I get that people don't want that kind of reporting, but I got to say, journalism is here to give people the information they need to be free and self-governing. And we are reporting on behalf of the public and our democracy. And that's why I felt I needed to be there, to hear what was being said there and to let others know.
So did this feel personal, or to you, does it represent a larger dynamic between politicians and the free press?
It is a larger dynamic that's been coming on for a while. Like, I've seen in the last 8 years or so, like, certain politicians refusing to participate in public debates sponsored by, say, the League of Women Voters. And it's concerning, because if you're going to be responsible to the public, you need to respond to the public.
And in the last 20 seconds or so, has Williams said anything else about your ousting since it gained traction in the media?
He has called me a fake journalist. I'm not.
Sandra Fish, data journalist and politics reporter for the Colorado Sun. Sandra, thank you so much for sharing your story with us this morning. We appreciate
it. Thanks, Jackie.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for a slight chance of mixed rain and snow tonight, with a low around freezing. Saturday, expect sunny skies to return, followed by a clear night. The high is near 50 and the low is around freezing. Sunday will be warm and sunny again, with a high around 55 degrees, followed by a mostly clear night with a low around 30. This has been the news for Friday, April 12th. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 970-728-3206. Koto News is scaling back for spring break, with newscasts on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday during that time. we will start back with our full news programming on April 22nd.